ruse. Felix flew at the fence like a chimp. His feet created toe holds, one above the other, as he propelled himself upward, climbing with surprising agility. He would have reached the top and tumbled down on the other side if Pearl hadn't cried out. Her exclamation was rendered in the ancient language of panic. Felix released his hold on the fence and dropped back to the ground. The boggart had gained on Pearl, and it was clear she couldn't move fast enough to outrun him. He was a good 10 years younger and perhaps not physically fit, but in better shape than she was. In a canny way, she knew her weight was an advantage, the sheer mass of her being a force to contend with. Breathing hard, she turned to face the bum and planted her feet. As he reached for her, she pulled her fist back and punched him without ceremony. His head barely moved as he absorbed the blow. He shook himself like a wet dog while Pearl started up the hill again. The bum lunged forward and grabbed her by the foot. She kicked at him repeatedly, forcing him to release her. Before she could scramble out of his reach, he grabbed her again and pulled her feet out from under her. I saw her sprawl forward, and then he was on her. Felix moved toward the two. He was operating on autopilot, converting raw adrenaline to action. He approached with deliberation, his arm out straight, his hand extended in front of him. Pearl was still down. The burly man swung an arm up, a knife gripped in his fist. Pearl managed to turn to one side as the blade came down, slashing the tough faux leather sleeve of her jacket. Felix stretched forward, and the bum recoiled, uttering a harsh cry. Belatedly, I realized Felix had hit him with a shot of pepper spray. The panhandler rolled away from Pearl, blinded and howling. Unfortunately, Pearl had inhaled the same irritant. Her cough was sudden and relentless, as debilitating as the spray that caught the bum in the face. Pearl got herself up on all fours, coughing uncontrollably. Felix pulled her to her feet. Behind them, the bum bent helplessly from the waist. The pepper spray had created a fiery distraction, excruciating pain that might have stopped a lesser mortal, but wouldn't delay him for long. Felix grabbed Pearl under one arm, and the two of them lumbered toward the fence. I slid under the fence in one continuous motion, knowing I didn't dare pause for fear of getting myself snagged. I came up on the far side, rose to my feet, and hauled up the curl of fencing far enough to allow Pearl to hunch herself under. Her jacket caught in a stretch of raw tines that tore into the dense fabric like fishing hooks. Felix was, by then, on my side of the fence, having scaled it and rolled over the top before he thudded to the ground. Pearl's jacket was impaled, and she was stuck halfway under the fence with little room to maneuver. She backed up abruptly, shed the jacket, and rolled over onto her back, this time head first. She dug her heels into the soft ground as I had, kicking her way through while Felix and I raised the raw chain link as far up as we could. We hauled her by the arms and pulled her to safety. She was breathing heavily, and she moaned more from fear, I suspect, than from pain. Her eyes were pink and swollen from the cloud of pepper spray, and her cough picked up again. Her nose ran as steadily as the trickle from a hose. We urged her toward the car, but she stopped where she was, hands on her knees. I gotta get my jacket. No, you don't. She ignored me, dropped to her hands and knees again to rescue the garment, which she managed with one quick jerk. Felix and I each grabbed one of Pearl's arms, supporting her on either side while she stumbled between us. Once we reached the car, we left her sitting sideways in the passenger seat with the door ajar. I opened the trunk, Felix snatched the backpack and the duffel and tossed them in. I banged the trunk shut. Together we lifted Pearl's feet and swung them into the car, slamming the door on her side. Felix came around to the driver's side and squeezed into the back. I flung my shoulder bag in after him. I got behind the wheel, slammed the door shut, and released the emergency brake. I felt the car move slowly. I started the engine as the Mustang picked up speed, and we continued rolling down the hill, gathering momentum. I directed my comment to Felix by way of the rearview mirror. Cool move. I didn't know you carried pepper spray. He flashed me a metallic smile. I don't. I stole it from them. Chapter 9. At the bottom of the hill, I gunned it through the parking lot and took a squealing turn onto Milagro, only belatedly checking to make sure there wasn't a cop car in range. I didn't for a moment imagine the boggart was hot on our tail, but I was shot through with adrenaline and couldn't suppress the urge to flee. A block farther up on Milagro, I took my eyes off the road long enough to look at Pearl. Why did you tear up the camp? What were you thinking?
They burned his books. They were using them as fuel.
So what? He's dead. The books don't mean anything to him. Who knows what they'll do to get even with you? Pearl held up a hand.
Stop. I gotta get out.
Are you going to be sick?
No, I'm not going to be sick, you dumb shit. I need a smoke.
Felix said. Hey, me too.
Oh, for heaven's sake, I snapped.
I searched for a stretch of curb that would allow me to ease out of the flow of traffic. In truth, I didn't trust myself to drive at that moment. I was wired and needed time to compose myself. Milagro was a busy thoroughfare, and I felt distracted and out of sorts. I activated my left turn signal and took the side street that bordered the McDonald's parking lot. The light had faded, and the few trees on the grassy strip between the street and the sidewalk created a shadowy haven. I spotted a long gap between two parked vehicles and did a nifty job of parallel parking, which I notice is usually better done without too much thought. I killed the engine and listened to the tick of hot metal while Pearl got out. Felix followed her out the passenger side door. I emerged on my side and leaned against the door frame, legs extended behind me as though to loosen my hamstrings. I rested my cheek on my outstretched arms and waited for my heart to slow. 10 feet away, I could see Felix's hands shake. Beads of sweat appeared on Pearl's forehead in response to the unaccustomed physical exertion. Her eyes still watered from the capsicum, and tears trickled down her cheeks. She sniffed and then leaned to one side and blew her nose through her fingers, which she wiped on her jeans. I don't know why I expected anything more from her. A quick look at my watch told me it was 7:10, too late to take them back to the shelter, which by now would be locked for the night. In theory, they would have been safe at Harbor House, but I knew it was the first place the boggarts would check if they decided to retaliate. Felix fumbled a pack of cigarettes from his shirt pocket. I said, "Why'd you bum a cigarette from her when you already had a pack?"
"She don't mind." "The hell I don't."
Felix's pack of cigarettes was smashed, and the first 2 cigarettes he pulled out were broken in half. He tossed the first away.
"Give me that," Pearl said.
She snatched the 2nd cigarette, which was little more than a stub with strands of tobacco hanging out. He offered her a light and then extracted a 3rd cigarette and lit it for himself. Almost simultaneously, they inhaled, sucking smoke so far down into their lungs, I thought they'd hyperventilate. I experienced a brief flash of what it felt like to light up in times of stress, but I don't think I actually whimpered aloud.
"You two are nuts," I said.
"Cigarettes are expensive, and they're bad for you."
Pearl scowled. "What's it to you? Clearly you never smoked a day in your life."
"I did, too. I smoked for 2 years before I gave it up."
"Then you ought to be more compassionate."
"I'm not the warm, fuzzy type. I thought that's why we got along so well." She smiled, exposing her 4 bottom teeth with wide gaps between.
"Lord help me, I think I'm getting attached to you."
"God forbid." She took a final drag from her cigarette and crushed the butt underfoot.
"Woo. Better. Why don't we take a look at what we got here?"
"By all means," I said. I grabbed my shoulder bag from the back seat and dug through the contents for my penlight, which I flicked on. I closed the car door and walked around to the rear where the 3 of us convened. I popped open the trunk and removed the backpack. I handed it off to her, then reached for the duffel and set it on the pavement between us. Pearl flipped the backpack upside down. The frame was constructed of hollow links of aluminum tubing, each of the four ends capped with a rubber shoe. Pearl removed one and turned the frame right side up again. She gave it a couple of shakes, and I heard the tinkle of metal on pavement. I shone the light down on the long, flat key that had fallen out of the frame. She leaned over, with effort, and picked it up. I held out my hand, and she placed it in my palm. I studied it in the beam of my penlight. The key to Dace's safe deposit box had notches of varying depths along one side. I turned it over. No bank name, no address, and no box number. "This is blank," Pearl said.
"Of course it is. You find that, they don't want you to walk in and claim stuff that ain't yours."
I said, "You couldn't do that anyway. To get into a safe deposit box, they ask for your ID and your signature, which has to match the one they keep on file."
"No kidding," Felix said. "Even if the box is yours for real, and you got the key and everything, that don't seem right."
"I don't suppose either one of you knows where Terrence did his banking." Pearl said,
"Nope. Though you gotta figure it's somewhere in walking distance. That limp of his, he couldn't go far."
"Unless he took a cab," I said.
"Good point."
I offered her the key. "You might as well keep this. You worked hard enough for it."
"Hey, no. You hang on to it. Once you figure out where the box is, you can let us know. I'm curious why he'd keep his valuables in a bank when that's exactly where a bank robber's going to hit first."
She set the backpack aside and loosened the mouth of the canvas duffel. She peered in and then upended it, shaking out the contents. A wad of old clothes tumbled out, drab, worn, and smelling of mildew. I flashed a beam across the pile. The only exception to the whole raggedy-ass collection was a neatly folded cotton shirt with a button-down collar and long sleeves, the fabric a brightly colored green and yellow plaid. When she picked up the shirt, a pair of glasses and a photo ID fell out.
"That's Charles," she said. "Terrence's friend who died."
"What was Terrence doing with his stuff?"
"Keepsake. Terrence had a sentimental streak, and that was really all the fella had."
The remaining items were a washed-out gray, cheap goods he probably plucked from a garbage can or a Salvation Army bin.
"What kind of world is it that when life ends, all that's left looks like junk?" she asked.
She picked up the plaid shirt and rolled it around the glasses and ID, which she shoved back into the duffel, followed by everything else. I was waiting for further comment, but she was staring off down the street. I didn't think we'd netted much for the risk we'd taken.
"That's everything?"
I asked.
"Pretty much."
"So, now what?" She said,
"You want, we can put our heads together while we have us a bite to eat. QP with cheese would really hit the spot."
I stared at her with interest. What a truly fine idea. Pearl and Felix settled into a booth near a window looking out onto the side street where the Mustang was parked. I stood in line waiting my turn, then placed our order, paid the tab, and watched while our meal was assembled. 3 QPs with cheese, 2 Big Macs, 3 large orders of fries, and 3 Cokes. The Big Macs were for them, though I'd have been willing to suck on the paper wrappers if they offered me the chance. I crossed to the table with the tray and distributed the food. I noticed Pearl kept the backpack beside her, the canvas duffel tucked between her feet. We ate without saying much, each of us intent on the fragrant blend of meat and cheese, grilled to a fare-thee-well, tucked in a soft bun, and liberally doused with the ketchup we squeezed from little plastic envelopes. I'd picked up extra salt packets, and we spared ourselves nothing in the way of additives, preservatives, and sodium chloride. I let Felix bust the table, after which we returned to the car and got in.
"Where should I drop you?"
Pearl said.
"Anywhere at the beach is fine. We'll figure it out from there."
I fired up the Mustang, cruised down one block and over one, eventually turning right onto Milagro. I headed for Cabana Boulevard. The combination of junk food and the sharp drop in my stress levels had left me logy and longing for sleep. In an attempt to make conversation, I said, "How'd you two end up on the street? That can't be much fun." Felix leaned forward on the seat, inserting himself between the two of us, like the family dog on an outing. "More fun than you'd think. I ran off when I was 15 and went to live with my dad." Pearl smiled at him. "This guy's epileptic. Had a brain injury, didn't you?" "Yep. My mom come after me with a ball-peen hammer. Soft-faced instead of hard, which she said was a lucky break for me. She give me such a whack she knocked me out cold. When I come to, I was seeing stars and didn't have a clue where I was at. Didn't bleed much, but my head hurt bad. After that, I started having fits, 10 to 15 a day." "She claimed he only did it to embarrass her," Pearl said. "That's right. She didn't take me to the doctor for 2 years. Said the fits was phony baloney I came up with just to bug the shit out of her. Couldn't prove it by me. I'd be fine, and then I'd be down on the ground pissing myself." Pearl said, "By the time she took him for help, the seizures damaged his brain." "She said I didn't have much brains to begin with, so no big loss," he said. "I'm fine as long as I take my pills."
"That's right. And don't you forget," she said, and pointed a finger at him.
He smiled happily, grungy braces glinting on his teeth.
"She's tough. Her and Dandy watch out for me. Better than your mom did, that's for sure."
I caught his eye in the rearview mirror. "Who paid for your braces?"
"My dad."
"What happened to him?"
"He got tired of me, I guess. One day he went off and didn't come back. After that, I was on my own."
"What about you, Pearl?"
"I was afraid you'd get around to asking. I'm chronically unemployed. Never had a job my whole life. None of my family did. I take that back. Once my daddy was hired on a construction crew for 2 weeks and 2 days. He said it was way more work than it paid. He maintained it was just one more way to take advantage of the poor. After that, the state took care of us," she said. "How about yourself? The business you're in, what do you do all day?"
"It varies. Process serving, paper searches at the courthouse, background checks, sometimes I sit surveillance. Once a case is wrapped up, I write reports and send out invoices so I can pay my bills."
"Now see right there. That's dumb. I don't have bills. I don't owe anyone a dime, so in that respect, I'm better off than you."
I stared at her briefly, thinking she was pulling my leg.
"Up here is fine," she said, indicating the intersection where Cabana Boulevard met State Street.
I pulled over to the curb across the street from the public parking lot near the wharf. "You have a place to sleep?"
"As long as the cops don't hassle us," she said.
I was skeptical, though in truth the only alternative I could think of was an invitation to stay at my place. And how would that play out? The two of them on my sofa bed, Felix on the sofa and Pearl in bed with me. "I can give you a few bucks for a motel," I said.
"We don't take handouts. Boggarts do that," she said.
"Sorry, my mistake," I said. Felix said,
"That's all right, you didn't know. Thanks for dinner. It was a treat. I kept me a couple packets of ketchup in case I get hungry later."
The two of them got out, Pearl toting the backpack, while Felix carried the duffel in his arms like a dog.
"Thanks for the help," she said, holding up the backpack.
"You two better keep an eye out," I said. "Those guys will be cruising to get even."
"Doesn't scare me," she said. "Bunch of bozos."
As I pulled away, I kept an eye on them in the side-view mirror. They waited patiently, clearly unwilling to move while I still had them in my sights. Wherever they intended to hole up for the night, they didn't want me to know. What a pair. Pearl, round as a beach ball, and Felix, with his gummed-up braces and his white boy dreads. Why did the sight of them make me want to weep? Wednesday morning, having worked my way through my usual routine, I went into the office where I put on a pot of coffee and opened the mail from the day before. Despite the fact that business was non-existent, I'm happier at my desk than just about any place else. I took out my index cards, intending to jot down a few notes, when the phone rang. It was Aaron Blumberg returning my Monday morning call with apologies for taking so long. "Don't worry about it," I said. "I know you've been busy. I figured you'd get back to me when you had the chance. Have you heard from Sacramento?" "Not a peep," he said. "What about you? Anything on your end?" "Actually, I've picked up quite a bit," I said. I gave him a quick summary of the blanks I'd filled in, including the dead man's full name and the fact that he'd lived in Bakersfield for some years. I also told him about Dandy, Pearl, and Felix as my source for much of the information. According to the scuttlebutt, Dace was sentenced to life in prison, but no one seems to know what he did or why he was released. I'd love to find out what that's about. "Me and thee both. Give me the name again." "Last name, Dace. First initial R, but I don't know what it stands for, Richard, Robert. His beach buddies are convinced he had money because he went to the trouble to draw up his last will and testament with the three of them serving as witnesses. I didn't see the document among his effects, but you might try his sleeping bag in case he sewed it into the lining or something of the sort. I have what they claim is the key to his safe deposit box, so that's another possibility, and probably a better bet." "I'll take a look at the sleeping bag," he said. "You know where he was incarcerated?" "Soledad, though I take it that was a subject he didn't care to discuss." "Nice. I'll pull up his criminal history on my computer. Date of birth?" "Don't have that. You worked in Kern County not that long ago. Seems like Bakersfield PD or the Sheriff's Department could fill you in." "I'll see what my buddies have to say. You know where he did his banking?" In the background, I could hear Aaron tapping out a note to himself on his computer. "I don't, but I was just setting out on a scouting mission, if that's okay with you. I know bankers can be tight-lipped, but I'm hoping someone will at least confirm a customer relationship. It'll help if I can drop your name into the conversation, like I've been officially blessed." "Do that. Once we know which bank we're dealing with, I'll see if we need a court order to get into the box. Did you find out what he was doing with your phone number?" "He was hoping to contact family in the area and needed an intermediary. I was recommended by a pal of mine named Pinky Ford. You remember him from the warehouse shootout last May?" "Oh, man, do I ever," he said. "You did good. R. Terrence Dace from Bakersfield. I'll get back to you as soon as I get a line on him." Once in my car, I went back to the beach and began driving the surface streets, starting from the point where Terrence pitched his tent. I'd decided Pearl was right about his doing his banking business in walking distance. While he could have taken a cab, it was money he probably wouldn't have wanted to spend. A man who won't pay for shelter isn't likely to pay for taxi rides. There were 5 banks in Montebello, another 12 in downtown Santa Teresa. 9 were scattered over a 6-block strip of State Street, and another 3 on Santa Teresa Street, which runs parallel to State. Once I plotted my course, I began with the closest financial institution and worked my way outward. Doing a canvass of any kind can be tedious, unless you're in the proper frame of mind. I took a zen-like approach. This was the job I'd assigned myself. It wasn't about finding the right answer, it was about patience and diligence. I surrendered to the process, ascribing the same importance to this work as to anything else I did. This is the gist of the conversation I initiated in every bank I entered. First, I'd ask the nearest teller if I could see the bank manager, who was usually visible at his desk in a modest glass cubicle or maybe seated at a nondescript desk on the floor. After I introduced myself to the manager or assistant manager, I'd show my current driver's license and a photostat of my investigator's license, and then hand over my business card. I'd mention R. Terrence Dace and ask if he'd been a customer. I'd explain that the key to a safe deposit box had been found among his effects. I'd toss Aaron Blumberg's name out at the first opportunity, indicating that the coroner's investigator would make arrangements to open the box in the presence of a bank officer once we knew where the deceased did his banking. Mention of the coroner's investigator worked like magic. Operating on my own, I doubted anyone would have given me the time of day. I hit pay dirt in the 10th bank when the teller referred me to an assistant vice president named Ted Hill, who nodded at the mention of Dace's name. "Mr. Dace was a valued customer. I'm sorry to hear he's passed on." "I gather he was ill for some time," I said. "The coroner's office wondered if a court order would be required to get into the box."
"That's not necessary. We're happy to cooperate with the public administrator's office. Tell Mr. Blumberg we'll do anything we can to help. Have him call, and we'll set up an appointment at his convenience."
And just like that, the lid to Pandora's box flew open. It would take me another day before I understood how many imps had been freed. But for the moment, I was inordinately pleased with myself. Chapter 10. I left the bank and drove home. I'd promised to help move supplies and equipment from Henry's guest rooms back into the storage areas off the kitchen at Rosie's Tavern, and I wanted to make good on the offer. I found a parking space and walked the short distance to the studio, noting that Henry's station wagon was already sitting in the drive, the back hatch opened in preparation for loading. I rounded the corner just as Henry emerged from the house, toting a cardboard box laden with packaged goods. I half expected to see William in the backyard leaning on his cane, but he was nowhere in evidence. "Where's William? I thought he'd be supervising." "I dropped him off for his physical therapy appointment. I'll pick him up in an hour. In the meantime, I thought I might as well start loading up. Seems silly to drive half a block, but I refuse to haul it all by hand." "I have a quick call to make, and then I'll pitch in," I said. "Is there a scheme in the works, or is it grab and go?"
"I've been picking up items in random order. When William gets back, we'll park him in Rosie's kitchen, and he can tell us how he wants the shelves arranged."
"How's he doing?"
"Don't ask."
"What about the cat?"
"Ed's fine. He slept in my bed with his head on the pillow next to mine." "And don't roll your eyes."
"I won't, I swear."
I rolled my eyes as soon as my back was turned, but I was smiling as I did so. I unlocked the studio and set my shoulder bag on the nearest stool. I put a call into Aaron, who picked up on the second ring. I gave him Ted Hill's name and the name of the bank. "It doesn't sound like he's going to be a butt about getting into the box," I said.
"Do you want to be there?"
"Absolutely, I'd love it."
"Good. I'll talk to Hill and get back to you."
I left the studio door open in case Aaron called back while I was moving items. Henry was better at loading than I was, so I delivered boxes and left it up to him to determine how to stack and stow them in the back of the station wagon. The cat supervised our efforts, climbing in and out of the car, walking across the seat back and perching in the spot with the best view, usually right where Henry intended to put a box. The vet had told Henry the cat was less than 2 years old, and it was clear he'd retained many of his kittenish ways. I'm not going to report every cute thing the cat did, but I noticed both Henry and I had taken up baby talk in our inane, ongoing conversational exchange with him. Henry swore Ed understood English, though he didn't seem that interested in what we had to say. Whatever the cat's native tongue, His tone of voice couldn't be the same high-pitched, goofy one Henry and I had adopted in our comments to him. I always knew having a cat around would do this to me, which is why I've resisted. I'd thought Henry and I were of like minds, but clearly he'd lost his. Aaron called at 6 o'clock that night. We'd completed the move. Henry and William were still over at Rosie's, reorganizing the goods and equipment. They'd insisted they didn't need my help, so I'd come home to shower. The phone rang as I was coming down the spiral stairs in a fresh pair of jeans and a sweatshirt. "We're meeting Ted Hill at the bank at 9, Aaron said when I picked up the phone. "He's got a 9:30 appointment at the Colgate branch, so he'll have one of the tellers oversee our efforts. Once he's sure the situation's under control, he'll leave us to our work. Why don't I meet you at that little coffee shop across the street and buy you breakfast before we go to the bank?"
Great. To what do I owe the pleasure?
Department has a slush fund we use to pay the occasional confidential informant. I told the coroner you'd rustled up some good intel, saving me the work. I suggested you should be compensated for the time you put in.
Well, on that basis, I'm happy to accept.
In the morning, I skipped my run. I could have made an earlier start or shortened the distance to carve out sufficient time, but I was in the mood to take a day off. I slept in until 7:15, scandalously late by my standards. To celebrate the change of pace, I put on a pair of pantyhose, my black flats, and my black all-purpose dress. This versatile and completely wrinkle-resistant garment is the only bona fide dress I own. Good for cocktail parties, funerals, and semi-solemn occasions in between. I flapped a ceremonial rag across the shoulders where a fine layer of dust had settled. After that, I figured I was good to go. I found a space in the parking structure adjacent to the coffee shop. Aaron had been watching for me, and he rose to his feet politely when he saw me come in the door. I joined him in a booth by the window, where we could watch foot traffic out on the street. Clerks, judges, court reporters, lawyers and their clients heading for the courthouse. A black and white bus, designated as the Santa Teresa County Sheriff's Department transport, pulled up at the curb and a parade of orange-clad and shackled inmates emerged from the vehicle and shuffled into the building, accompanied by 3 uniformed corrections officers. Aaron's hair was damp from his morning shower, comb tracks still evident as he handed me a menu and checked for the specials of the day. He wore a sport coat over a blue and white checked shirt with a folded necktie visible in the pocket. He looked up as the waitress approached, coffee pot in hand. She filled our cups and delivered small pods of half and half from a pocket in her apron. We ordered, Aaron opting for bacon, scrambled eggs, and wheat toast, while I asked for the steel-cut oats, which came with small containers arranged on a separate tray, brown sugar, raisins, blueberries, butter, candied pecans, and a small pitcher of cream, for which I substituted milk. We chatted about inconsequential matters, and once the waitress delivered the food, took time out to eat. Aaron ate faster than I did, and when he finished the last bite of toast, he ran his napkin across his mouth and then tucked it under his plate. "I heard back from Sacramento late last night with a match on the prints, which confirmed Dace's identity. I thought I'd fill you in on his criminal history before we go over to the bank."
"Ah, you must have talked to someone in Bakersfield."
"I pulled up his file and then put in a call to one of the Sheriff's Department homicide detectives."
"Am I going to like this?"
"You might. The story's actually more interesting than you'd think. Dace spent 12 years in prison on a felony murder conviction that was overturned a year ago."
"Who'd he kill?"
"I'll get to that. He'd had some earlier minor skirmishes with the law, a couple of DUIs, a charge of drunken disorderly that was later dismissed, nothing of significance. For years he ran his own tree-trimming company while he worked on a degree in landscape architecture, which he never got, by the way."
"So I heard.
Dandy tells me he was a bright guy and very knowledgeable."
Apparently so. He had a reputation for being a hands-on kind of boss. He could push a crew, but he was more than willing to get up there himself when it came to proper pruning. In 1968, he took a bad fall, broke his shoulder and his left hip, which put him out of commission for a while. During his recovery, he got caught up in prescription drugs and heavy drinking, which he had a penchant for in any event. Some of this you may know. Not exactly, but close enough. I heard about the pain pills and alcohol, I said. I can't imagine how you get from trimming trees to felony murder, but I'm all ears. Well, he started on a downward spiral. You know how it goes. Once word got out about his boozing, his clients started dropping him, which meant his business went into the toilet. His wife threatened to kick him out, saying she didn't want the kids exposed to his bad behavior. He managed to hold his marriage together, but things weren't good by a long shot, and the only work he could get was day labor. A bunch of them would stand out on a corner, like hookers, while prospective employers cruised by in their half-ton trucks, looking them over and quizzing them about their skills. He and another fellow named Herman Cates picked up a couple days' work trimming trees. While I listened, I worked on my oatmeal. I pushed the raisins to the bottom of the bowl so the heat would plump them. Then I folded in the milk and sugar. My Aunt Jin favored a couple of pats of butter, but that's too decadent for my taste. Aaron was saying, "What Dace doesn't know is this guy Cates is a registered sex offender, and he has his eye on the teenaged girl in a bikini sunning herself the yard next door. She's abducted that night, and 2 days later they find her body stuffed in a sewer pipe half a mile away. She's been raped and strangled with the cord from the rope and pulley system on the very pruning saw Dace was using that day." I lowered my spoon. "Are you sure about this? I never even met the man, but I find that hard to believe." "Sheriff's department didn't have a problem with it. Cates was identified from a palm print left at the scene, and he's the one who implicated Dace. Eventually, Cates ended up on death row in San Quentin, but Dace insisted all along that he was innocent. His wife got on the stand and testified he was home the night the girl was kidnapped. Jury figured she was lying through her teeth. Vote on the guilty verdict was unanimous, and the judge sentenced him to life in prison. He spent the next 12 years writing letters to anyone and everyone. I've had letters from inmates, and they always sound like crackpots. Long, garbled tales about political conspiracies and corruption in the legal system." Aaron leaned forward. "Here's the kicker. 2 years ago, Cates finds out he's terminal. He's diagnosed with stage 4 lung cancer. 3 months to live at the outside, and he decides he doesn't want to die with a bad conscience. He finally tells the authorities Dace wasn't the guy, that it was someone else." "Amazing." "That's what I said. You'd think Cates recanting would be sufficient, but no deal. Prosecutor thinks it's bullshit. Dace's original defense attorney is retired and suffering early-stage dementia, so he's no help. The judge doesn't want to hear about it, and there's no one willing to go to bat for him. 25 letters later, an attorney finally agreed to look into Dace's claims. He went back and reviewed all the old police files and the evidence in storage, including a bloody shirt Dace had always sworn wasn't his. The attorney got a judge to sign an order submitting the semen sample and the bloody shirt for DNA testing that wasn't available back then. Sure enough, results ruled him out." "What about the real guy?" "He'd been killed in a prison riot 2 months before. Dace was freed, but his life was in pieces, as you might imagine. Humpty Dumpty. That's about it. This was a major embarrassment for the department. Let's not even talk about the DA's office. No one believed Dace was innocent. Some still won't accept the fact because who wants to take responsibility when you're that far off? Dace's attorney uncovered a host of other issues. Crucial reports were lost. Exculpatory evidence was swept under the rug." Aaron glanced at his watch and signaled the waitress for the check. "There's more,
but it can wait. We finished the last of our coffee, and Aaron paid the bill. We went out into the morning sun and crossed the street to the bank without saying a word. Dace's story made chit-chat seem inappropriate. Ted Hill had been watching for us, and he held the door open as we approached. Aaron introduced himself, and the two men shook hands. Both of us provided photo identification. Aaron had brought a letter from the coroner, identifying the John Doe as R.T. Dace, verifying the date and cause of death, and asking the bank's cooperation in the matter of the safe deposit box. Hill barely paid attention. Once he'd made up his mind to help, the official falderal didn't seem to matter to him. Hill introduced us to a teller named Joyce Mount, who would accompany us into the vault. Ted Hill excused himself and suggested Aaron call him later in the day. Aaron and I went into the vault with Ms. Mount. Aaron used the key we'd found in Dace's backpack, and the teller used the master. In fewer than 10 seconds, the safe deposit box was on the table in front of us. Aaron and I pulled up chairs side by side. The teller remained on hand as the bank's representative, probably as curious as we were about what we'd find. Aaron removed the contents of the box and fanned out the papers on the table. He had a notebook and he kept a written inventory, cataloging each item as he examined it and passed it on to me. The first was a savings account passbook. He flipped through, looking at a number of entries, and then checked the final balance. He blinked, made a note, and handed it to me. The account had been opened 9 months before, on January 8, 1988, which must have been shortly after Dace arrived in town. The initial deposit was $597,500. The last transaction, a withdrawal of $200, was date-stamped October 1, 1988, leaving a balance of $595,350. I said, "Whoa." I heard he had money, but I had no idea the total was anywhere close to this. I figured a couple of $100. Where did it come from? That's what I didn't have a chance to tell you. He went after the state and sued him for $12 million. $1 million for every year he was incarcerated. After weeks of haggling, he agreed to a settlement. At $600,000, the state got off cheap. He probably could have held out for more, but he wanted his life back. He had his freedom. His reputation was clean again, and he was eager to see his kids. At least I understood now why the bank valued Dace as a customer. Maybe they pegged him as eccentric. All that money, and he was still living like a tramp. The next item was a plain white number 10 envelope that contained school pictures of 3 kids, a boy and 2 girls, who I assumed were his. The first name, the name of the school, and the year, 1973, were noted on the back of each photo. A boy, Ethan, appeared to be in his mid-teens at the time the picture was taken. The middle child, a girl named Ellen, was probably 14, and the youngest, Anna, might have been 11 or 12. By now, the girls would be in their late 20s, the boy in his early 30s. Aaron and I both studied the faces before returning the photos to the envelope. The next document was a divorce decree in which Evelyn Chastain Dace was named as the plaintiff, and R. Terence Dace the defendant. Dissolution of marriage had been granted in August 1974. This document was followed by a quitclaim deed signed by R. Terence Dace as grantor, in which he had conveyed the described house and lot to Evelyn Chastain Dace, including all oil, gas, and minerals on and under the property owned by the two of them as joint tenants. The manila envelope that surfaced next was packed with a number of newspaper clippings from the Bakersfield Californian and the Kern County News, covering the period between February 28, 1972, and November 15, 1973, detailing the murder of a teenage girl who'd first been reported missing the morning of February 26, 1972. The black-and-white newspaper photo of the victim was enough to break your heart. She was a beautiful young woman with long, dark hair and a bright smile. I skimmed, picking up a paragraph here and there. It helped that Aaron had given me the broad strokes. Knowing how the story turned out put the bits and pieces into context. Herman Cates and R. Terence Dace were tried separately, court dates and appearances stretching over a protracted period, while both defendants were assigned court-appointed attorneys who probably requested time to prepare. Herman Cates and a second suspect, R. Terence Dace, were accused of the abduction and murder of 15-year-old Karen Coffey, a freshman at Bakersfield High School. Dace denied any involvement, and the state's case rested in large part on the eyewitness testimony of a neighbor who claimed that she saw Dace on the property the day of the abduction. Dace's defense attorney presented an alibi defense that he was home with his wife the night of the murder and therefore didn't have an opportunity to commit the crime. Mrs. Dace's testimony was supported by a next-door neighbor, Lorelei Brandel, who was at the house during the time in question. The defense also challenged Kate's credibility in tying Dace to the crime. The jury was unimpressed, and after deliberating for 4 hours, convicted Dace of felony murder. Dace was sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole, and began serving his time in January 1974. It wasn't difficult to imagine the sequence of events. After Dace's conviction and sentencing, his wife filed for divorce, insisting that he quit claim the house to her. Or maybe he'd voluntarily relinquished claim in light of his disgrace. Once he was freed from prison, sued the state, and collected his settlement, the money must have looked like a way to make amends. I could imagine him arriving in Bakersfield, eager to contact his children so he could tell them his name had been cleared. Big mistake. According to Dandy, the reunion was a disaster. In the end, they'd severed their relationship, and he'd traveled to Santa Teresa in hopes of reconnecting with whatever remaining family he could find. Occasionally, the teller would lean forward and look at an item herself, but for the most part, she seemed content to observe without comment. Aaron came to Dace's social security card and a California driver's license that had expired in May of 1976. He made a note of the social security number, Dace's full name, and his address at the time the license was issued. "The initial R stands for Randall," he remarked. "Good to know." He passed both documents to me after he added the information to his inventory. I checked the date of birth on his driver's license. Catch this. He was born in 1935, which means he's 53 years old. He looked more like 70 when I saw him. Nobody ever said drink, drugs, and cigarettes were the fountain of youth. I guess not. Aaron read and passed along paperwork related to the settlement, showing Dace's receipt of the money, his signature attesting to the fact that this was settlement in full, that he held the state harmless, and so forth. I added that document to the mounting pile of those we'd reviewed. The next items Aaron passed me were 3 16-page folios Dace had put together for his children. I recognized his characteristic printing style. The 3 booklets were handwritten and hand-bound. The first covered edible California plants, the second, medicinal herbs, and the third was devoted to California wildflowers. Included with the text were delicate drawings, some done in pen and ink, and some in colored pencil. There was a note attached to each, indicating which child was meant as the recipient. There was no way to know whether he'd put the folios together while he was still in prison or after his release. But I was struck by the care he'd taken. He couldn't have executed the intricate illustrations if he was drunk. These were like poems made visible, precise and lovingly rendered. For the first time, I realized Terence Dace was a talented man. With an innate intelligence and sensitivity few people in his life had reason to appreciate, how many hours had he spent on the project, and how much affection had he lavished on the drawings and the text? I hoped someone would track down his kids and deliver these in his behalf. It might make a dent in whatever ill will they bore him. The guy deserved better. The next envelope Aaron picked up was 5 inches by 8 and closed with a metal clasp. Aaron opened it and removed 4 black-and-white photographs. They were the old-fashioned Kodak prints edged in white. Aaron noted the topmost photo and studied it briefly before he picked up the next. I did the same thing as he passed each one along. Even the teller leaned forward to have a look. In the first, a tow-headed boy of 6 was perched on the shoulders of a rangy, good-looking man who was grasping the child's feet to anchor him in place. The background showed glimpses of flat, empty land. I could see a crumpled fence and 2 young trees. I pictured farmland and open countryside. On the back of the photograph, in pen, the note said, "Me and Uncle R., September 1941. The boy had to be Terence Dace. I'd seen him only once, in death, and while it was a stretch to trace the similarities between the child and the wreck of a man he'd become, the faint link was there. The second photo showed the same tow-headed boy progressed to age 10. This time he and his Uncle R. sat on the front stairs of a white frame house. Uncle R. on the top step, with Terence seated between his uncle's knees, 1 step down. The affection between the two was unmistakable. Behind them I could see a portion of a screen door. Off the bottom step there was a boot scraper shaped like a dachshund, and on the right, partially obscured, was a cast concrete planter filled with marigolds in desperate need of watering. Now I picked up the family resemblance, the same flop of straight hair, the same tilt to the eyes. This one was also marked, "Me and Uncle R." The date was June 4, 1945. The third and fourth photos were indoor shots, one with a Christmas tree showing in the background. Uncle R. wasn't visible. In fact, I was guessing he was the photographer. Young Terence, now perhaps 12, was the proud possessor of a .22-caliber rifle, the box and wrapping paper still in evidence at his feet. No date on the back. The fourth photo was taken in the kitchen, the same house and the same holiday, judging by Dace's shirt, which appeared in both. Terence and his Uncle R. toasted the season with clear glass punch cups held aloft. The drink might have been eggnog, something creamy-looking. The curve of whiskey bottle to the right suggested that Uncle R. had greatly improved his libation. He might even have accorded Dace a wee tot of Old Crow. This time Uncle R. was sitting at the boy's side, with his free arm slung across his shoulders. No wonder Dace had come looking for his Uncle R.'s kids. Uncle R. was family as he remembered it. Family as it was in the days when he was young and life was good. If he'd been estranged from his own children, it would be natural for him to dream of forging a bond with the only family he had left. He'd wanted to be clean and sober before he presented himself. According to Dandy, he'd been drunk until the day he died. So much for that idea. I heard the rustle of paper. "Well, this is a kick in the pants," Aaron said. I looked up to find him examining the final document, which was backed in blue. "Is that his will?"
"Indeed."
"What's the date? Dandy said it was July 8th.
"That's it," he said.
So not sewn into the lining of his sleeping bag after all.
"Nope."
"Are these the 3 witnesses you mentioned?" He flipped the pages and held out the final page so I could see the printed names and signatures. Pearl White, Daniel D. Singer, and Felix Bider. I realized that Dandy was the shorthand version of Daniel D. Dan D. I never heard their last names except Pearl's, and I wasn't sure that was correct. Dandy referred to her as Ms. Pearly White, but I thought it might have been a play on words. Aaron returned to the first page. Not a word about the disposition of his remains, but his kids might expect to have a say in the matter. He's got all three listed, but there's only one address, and that's his son, Ethan's. Nothing for the two girls, so maybe he didn't know where they were living. He turned to the second page, and I saw his gaze zigzag down the lines of print. His mouth turned down in an expression that suggested surprise. The guy was frosted, says here, I have intentionally omitted to provide in this will for my son Ethan or for my daughters Ellen and Anna, whose loathing and disdain are irreparable and who have repudiated our relationship and severed all ties. I said, Dandy told me about that. It must have been quite a blow-up. Well, this is helpful, Aaron went on. Says, be it known that I own no real property, have no debts, and have no assets other than the monies deposited in my savings account and the incidental personal effects in my safe deposit box. It is my desire that the executor of my estate should notify my children of my death and deliver the gifts I've set aside for them. If he's disinherited his kids, does it mean his money goes right back to the state? That would be a pisser, I said. Oh, no. He made sure he had all his ducks in a row. For starters, he set it up so the executor and sole beneficiary are the same. Meaning what? Is that a good thing or bad? It's not a problem one way or the other. I think the tricky issue lies elsewhere. He pushed the document across the table, and I leaned forward so I could read the name listed in two different places on the same page. I said, oh, because the name was mine. Chapter 11. I don't remember the drive home. I kept my emotions on hold, unable to accept what I'd been confronted with in black and white. Before Aaron and I left the bank, the teller made one copy of his inventory sheet for me and a second to be kept in the safe deposit box. She also made a copy of Dace's will, along with copies of the other paperwork, which she returned to the safe deposit box. Aaron received one packet, and I was given the other. Since I was named executor of the estate, she also handed me the original of the will to be submitted to the Superior Court clerk when it was entered into probate. I intended to contact an attorney as soon as possible because I already knew I was in over my head. I needed legal guidance, and I needed help understanding the full impact of this strange turn of events. This was like winning the lottery without buying a ticket. $500,000? Unreal. Out on the street, Aaron and I shook hands. I have no idea why. There was simply the sense that some agreement had been reached, and we'd sealed the bargain with that age-old gesture denoting courtliness and non-aggression. He said, at a totally mundane level, I still have Dace's sleeping bag. Looks like that belongs to you along with everything else. You want me to hang on to it? No, thanks. I can tell you right now I won't be crawling into that thing no matter how many times it's been cleaned. Once on my street, I parked, locked the car, passed through the squeaky gate, and went around to the back patio. I let myself in, dropped my shoulder bag on the counter, and sat down at my desk. I opened the file drawer and took out the folder where I kept the photocopy of my parents' marriage license application. I knew what I'd find, but I needed to see it again nonetheless. 4 years previously, a piece of my personal history had surfaced unexpectedly. In the course of an investigation, a woman I was interviewing made a remark about the name Kinsey, wondering aloud if I was related to the Kinsey family up in Lompoc, an hour north of Santa Teresa. I dismissed the idea, but something about the comment bothered me. I'd finally gone down to the courthouse where I searched public records and came up with the information my parents had supplied on the application for their marriage license, which listed my father's date and place of birth, my mother's date and place of birth, and the names of both sets of parents. And there it was. My mother, whose maiden name was Kinsey, was born in Lompoc, California. I was indeed a member of the Kinsey family, despite the fact that there had been no contact that I knew of in the years since my parents' death. At the time, I'd paid for a copy of the form which I'd placed in my files. Now I looked at it with new eyes. My paternal grandfather, my father's father, was Quillen Milhone. My grandmother's maiden name was Rebecca Dace. Their only son, my father, was Terence Randall Milhone, who went by the name Randy. He listed his place of birth as Bakersfield, California, which I'd forgotten. Terence Dace's full name was Randall Terence Dace. The two given names had probably been recycled through the family in variations from one generation to the next, going back who knows how far. If Rebecca Dace had brothers, it would explain how the surname Dace remained in play. Why hadn't I made the connection when I first heard the name? It's not as though Dace was a common name like Smith or Jones. The truth was, I'd been raised thinking of myself as an orphan. My Aunt Jen, for reasons of her own, had neatly sidestepped any talk of our family history. While she was intimately acquainted with the facts, she felt no compulsion to advise me of my antecedents. When assorted Kinsey relatives appeared in my life, I reacted as though my world were being invaded by aliens. I was unaccustomed to cousins and aunts, and I chafed at their overtures, which were motivated by goodwill. The existence of my maternal grandmother, Cornelia Straith LeGrand Kinsey, was a shock, and not one I received with grace. Over the past couple of years, I'd adjusted, more or less, but I wasn't entirely reconciled to any of it. In my defense, when I had first clapped eyes on the John Doe, cold and gray and still as stone on a gurney in the coroner's office, I'd had no reason in the world to believe the man was in any way related to me. Now, for all practical purposes, he belonged to me, and I was charged with the responsibility of overseeing the distribution of his assets, which apparently consisted entirely of cash, left entirely to me. Why did this seem so wrong? There was no mention in the will itself as to what he'd wanted done with his remains. I'd make arrangements for his funeral, but his children might want a part in that decision. Despite their rejection of him and his subsequent repudiation of them, he was still their father, and the issue was by no means settled. Whether his death did or did not change the emotional climate in their hearts, it was still my job to carry the news to them and to offer an olive branch. Surely his kids must have felt relieved when they learned of his innocence. Whatever the nature of their estrangement, at least the specter of their father as a sexual predator and cold-blooded killer had been laid to rest. The other question that bore consideration was this. If R.T. Dace and I were related, which appeared to be the case, then what was the connection? While it was only speculation on my part, the answer seemed obvious. Dace had come to Santa Teresa because he'd heard that his favorite Uncle R. had moved here with his family. He'd heard the news of his uncle's death, but he'd still thought he might contact surviving family members. The slip of paper in his pocket didn't refer to the personhood of Milhone, the private investigator. It was Milhone, the private citizen. The only conclusion that made sense was that Dace's favorite Uncle R. was my father, Randy Milhone. Terence Randall Milhone and Randall Terence Dace were related by blood, though I had no way of knowing if their relationship was actually that of uncle to nephew, or something more convoluted. If I was correct in tracing a line to my grandmother, Rebecca Dace, then Terence was most likely my cousin somewhere along that branch. This is what stopped me in my tracks. If I was right, then the four black-and-white photographs of Dace's Uncle R. were the only pictures of my father I'd ever seen. I shut the door on that painful notion, which I'd deal with once I had the snapshots in hand. Right now, they were tucked away in Dace's safe deposit box, along with the other documents I could lay claim to once I sorted through legal matters. I pulled out the telephone book and looked in the yellow pages under attorneys. In the subcategory, wills, trusts, and estate planning, there were 21 lawyers listed, and I'd never heard of one. It wasn't quite noon, so I picked up the phone and called Lonnie Kingman, my attorney of record. He's my go-to guy at the first sign of legal troubles, which have cropped up more than once in the course of my career. For a period of 3 years, we'd shared office space, and that he'd accorded me the use of his conference room for business purposes after I left California Fidelity Insurance. Eventually, his firm had outgrown the space he was in, and he'd bought an office building on Lower State Street, into which he'd moved some 2 years before. I realized with embarrassment that I'd never even stepped foot in the place. Maybe I should have considered that good news because it meant I hadn't been arrested, jailed, or legally threatened of late. Instead, I was forced, once again, to acknowledge the gaps in my upbringing. Aunt Jin hadn't fostered feelings of connectedness, and I hadn't had occasion to develop them on my own. Maybe it was time to at least pretend to be a nicer person than I knew I was. I dialed Lonnie's office number. When the receptionist had picked up, I identified myself and asked to speak to Lonnie. I didn't recognize the receptionist's name. She told me he was out of the country and wasn't expected back until the following week. What about John Ives? Is he in?
No, ma'am, he's not. Mr. Ives has left the firm and opened offices of his own. I can give you his number if you'd like.
Martin Cheltenham?
He moved to Los Angeles.
Who's left?
I can put you through to Mr. Zimmerman.
What's his specialty?
Personal injury.
Do you have anyone who handles estate law? Wills? Dead people? Anything like that?
Burke Benjamin.
Fine, I'll take him.
Her.
Right. Could you put me through?
She's not here at the moment, but I expect her back after lunch. Shall I set up an appointment?
Please. I'm a friend and longtime client of Lonnie's, and I can be there at 1 o'clock if she's available.
Looks like it to me. I'll make a note of it.
Thanks so much. I spelled my name for her. She asked for my phone number, and I dutifully recited it. I thought she might ask for a credit card number, like a restaurant hedging against no-shows, but she let it go at that. I used the time before my appointment to get out my index cards and transfer information from the photocopies of the paperwork in Dace's safe deposit box, California driver's license, which included his then address, his social security number, and his son's street address in Bakersfield. There was no phone number that I could find. There were other incidental bits and pieces I consigned to index cards, which were easier to carry with me than an 8x11 folder. I created a file for him, into which I tucked the photocopies. It looked like there would be much more to follow before I was through with him. The three